and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war.
The right-wing sect which declared war on the United States government in 1984 had many names. The Brüder Schweigen, German for Solid Brotherhood, the White American Bastion, and the Order. Former members revealed that a special order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During a shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Order members say that the war has just begun.
Bob really one hell of a man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs. There's very few men like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
The government's weak. The government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up, told the federal government that we have 5,000 men who would die right now, what we believe in, the government can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on, and I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they call the ZOG, the Zionist Occupational Government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984 when the order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war, and I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, War.
This is a time of rapid communication, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech if they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television talk show aired on Community Access Cable Television.
Reason that show dedicated to free speech.
When FBI agents moved in on the order, members were within a few weeks of cracking Brink Central Vault here in San Francisco. With more than $30 million, they could have bought and outfitted an army.
I need my own state. I need my own nation. I need to have my own schools for my daughter, for my son, for my family.
When Nero tried to persecute the Christians in the Roman times, it did not eradicate them. And I do not believe it will eradicate us.
Just a few will be enough to reignite the spark for us to rise again. It's not over by any means. It's just a start.
We enjoin all people to choose intelligently which side they will be on. Make sure that you have the greatest number of relevant facts possible. There will surely come a day
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Oh, wait a minute. We switched back. White Area and Resistance Radio. Boy, you get in a rut sometimes. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. Here we are in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Fillet Station, where we still sell Ethel and regular, with Ethel inside the bar serving the beer. Yeah, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show and other projects like our POW programs, sending books and articles and so forth to POWs and prisoners in general to educate them, help them get learn something. Sometimes we send them technical books and things like that. So, anyhow, it is the 11th of September, 2014, on Thor's Day. Boy, I'll tell you, our temperature dropped. It did drop during the night. It's down in the was down in the 50s this morning, and it's wet, rainy, and I'm telling you, I think we're going to head for an early fall, maybe an early winter this year, but I don't want to get too excited and become hysterical about it, so anyhow, we'll just hang in there and see what happens. And go to resist.com for our main programs, all kinds of PDF books up there for free, back radio shows that go back hundreds of shows for free up there, so you can get a equivalent of a Harvard racial education up there at resist.com. And my email is tm_metzger@yahoo.com. And if you have any other questions that I might not be able to answer, because I've got a great webmaster. Yeah. And so your email is merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. I got it right this time. Okay. All righty. Let's see here. Whoa, I'm looking at the wrong screen here. No wonder it wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. Well, we like to play that once in a while about the order. It's not forgotten, and the declaration of war has never been rescinded. Anyone out there who thinks it has or was is sadly mistaken. What Robert J. Matthews and other people created is still out there. It's still out there. The foundation, the philosophy, and so forth are still out there. So, well, I received a big article off the internet put out by MajorityRights.com. And it goes through, well, they call it right-wing extremists, like the order. They got a whole list of people who've been involved in one area or another of the racial cause on here. And then it said some nice things about me. I can't believe it because, number one, most of the people on the list are still right-wingers. But I want you to understand that I left the right wing quite some time ago. But still, it's fine to be on the list there because people who read my stuff know where I'm coming from. So I'll see what they say.
It's 1 o'clock.
Hey, 1 o'clock? Oh, okay. What the order was attempting in a far more elaborate plan than most people realize was fairly analogous to what Joseph Pilsudski and his Bojaki group did with the Burzdeni train robbery and other operations in order to fund the reinstatement of Poland. There are also parallels with the Sons of the Revolution who fought for independence from Britain. We might go on to discuss them among other guerrilla campaigns which fought for independence. That is naturally revolution, and taking or retaking of a nation can entail extreme activities according to the status quo and powers that be. But to begin discussion, a comparison of Bob Matthews and Joseph Pilsudski is relevant to normalization as the parallels are clear, yet Pilsudski is not stigmatized, and he is widely accepted as a national hero in Poland. Well, here's an interesting little blurb in this off this website. Are we to be cannon fodder for war on behalf of the white plutocrats? I think not. While we are addressing the David Duke and his single greatest cause issue, Jewish power and influence, with his admonition against their strategy of divide and conquer, we should ask, is it not possible that our traitorous white plutocrats would be happy to have us fight a war against that which is also their greatest enemy, Jewish power and biocultural patterns, and use us as cannon fodder? What, after all, have they done for us? What have they done to merit our loyalty? What have they done to fight Jewish power and influence? Mass non-white immigration into European people's habitats? The destruction of European cultures and people? Yeah, that's a good question. I continue here. David Duke proposes that we divest concern for all other antagonists to whites and focus singularly on the Jewish power. And you know, I hear this a lot now. There's a lot of non-whites nibbling around the edges of our cause. And go around calling people racist. Jews, the most racist of all, because they have an apartheid nation and prohibit intermarriage. To the contrary, to denounce racial discrimination, now that is stupid. Racism, social classification, and discrimination accordingly is exactly what we need to normalize and institutionalize. We do not need to normalize and institutionalize its prohibition. He says that we need to appeal to people in their ordinary understanding, thus ought to care deeply about exotic cultures, the black family, not to use the N-word, as that would be playing into the divide and conquer. We need to appeal to people. Hitler was offering neighboring nations a good deal. This mythic normalcy exacerbates the misconception that we need to revive Nazism and to totally debunk the Holocaust, because with that, hold out hope for corrupt white corporatists to turn sponsorship our way to do anything but use us as cannon fodder. These failed programs are an albatross that have stigmatized the project of resuscitating the necessary life function of benign classification of peoples and benign discrimination accordingly. Agreed. Anyhow, the MajorityRights.com has got a lot of semi-intellectual, and they batted around quite a bit. They do mention me once in a while. Of course, I was on their radio show once, too. But the main thing we have to understand is that fratricide cannot win anything. It's sort of like if you look at Adolf Hitler in Germany, this extreme nationalism and Germanic idea, no matter what they thought the end product would be, the fact was that millions of white people, millions of Europeans, including European Russians, were killed. So no matter what the plan was, whether it was real or not so real, the results were disaster. We can't afford to have fratricidal warfare, whether it's a European-Ukraine person or a European-Russian person, and to be encouraging young people to go from one country to another in Europe just to get into a bloodletting is counter-racial. And that's why I have pretty much left the right. And I don't want to call myself necessarily a left-winger, but I would say as a pan-Aryanist, an Aryan socialist, along those lines, much closer to the Strassers in Germany than I would have been with Hitler. Because under Strasserism, it might not have been the perfect answer, which no answer is perfect. But Germany would not have been destroyed in an international war. That is something we can't afford. World War II and World War I, actually, there's only been one war, one and two, all hooked together. and look at the racial material that was destroyed. I hear these people in the right wing now that are all behind these people warring against each other in eastern Ukraine, which is quite a bit of fratricide going on there, and they're all excited about it. But like I said this morning to them, I said, you know, are you wanting to destroy the village to save the village? Remember that from Vietnam? The white race is dropping in numbers greatly. And it can't afford fratricidal struggles. People are going to have to learn to bite their lip and move on. Extreme nationalism is a trap. Been a trap for a long time. I guess it comes out of tribalism. There's a need for tribalism, but when tribalism ends up destroying massive numbers of white people, then it's wrong. There's no benefit at all for these fratricidal struggles, except to help the non-whites of the world and their plutocrat bosses. And so, when I see these young people getting all excited, want to grab a gun and go fight the Soviets, I'll remind them they're not Soviets anymore. And for the Russians to be fighting many of the Ukrainians, that's a waste too. If something's rotten, it's going to fall primarily on its own, like this country. I watched a film last night in the line of fire with our old buddy. That movie was with Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich. And I was surprised how well that film held up after all these years, since the early 90s, I guess it was. John Malkovich was a federal or a CIA hitman who'd been screwed over by his own agency. He was an excellent at what he did. And as far as I'm concerned, if it had been real life, Malkovich would have been successful in his endeavor to assassinate the president. Clint Eastwood was trying his best, but a pro like Malkovich would have easily gotten around him. But it brings us around to this thing about, people have this thing about, if we could only get rid of this person or that person, everything would be fine. No, that's not the way the system runs. When one dies, 10 people are standing around wanting a job, wanting his job. So assassination is a very poor way of gaining power. It may shift power, like with Kennedy. It shifted power around. It shifted probably several times. But it didn't change things overall. So anyhow, I just was thinking about that people always talking about, well, if I could bump this person off or bump that person off, things would change. Usually it doesn't. Usually corrupt systems destroy themselves, like a snake eating its own tail, and that's what I say here. There's not a whole hell of a lot can be done at the moment. But this system is definitely coming apart. I think there's going to be a lot of federal people that are going to see that and become enemies of the state as time goes on, and they'll be quite valuable. Like this person was valuable, at least to his own endeavor of what he wanted to do in this film. But it's hard to have patience when you see our numbers and population dropping. But on the other hand, to do things that are foolhardy, that take you out of the game, is even worse. Our job is to keep the powder dry, so to speak, know what our philosophy and political goals are, and know what we have to do when the time comes to do it. In the meantime, we watch the system disintegrating and attempting to see what you think the plutocrats and the big boys are going to do when it really gets bad and coming to their doorstep. But one thing we know we can't do is, like the right wing, who technically worship the rich. I know people for years in the right wing who have this thing, and of course they believe they're capitalists. Whereas, of course, they're not capitalists. They don't even understand the goals of capitalism is just for a few people to own everything and everybody. Actually, extreme capitalism is similar to the Soviet Union, where the so-called misnamed Communist Party controlled everything and everybody. That's the goal of capitalism, to control all the wealth and power over the people. And that's what it is, predatory capitalism. You can be a free enterpriser, that's a person working, small businessmen, artisans, people like that. That's free enterprise. Someone who comes up with an ingenious idea in their garage or something and builds it into a multi-billion dollar outfit, that's free enterprise. The plutocrats deal in the breeding of money. The Greeks call it tokos, the breeding of money, without working for it, other than shuffling figures around. Those are the really bad boys, and they took us for trillions in these last few years, the whole world, to where 3% of the population control 85% of the wealth in the world. So, anyhow, that's not good. That's not good. Anyhow, you get a chance to see that in The Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood and Malkovich. You've probably seen it before, but it's surprising how many of these movies, if you haven't seen it for years and you forget a lot of what was going on, you watch them again, you say, gee, I forgot that. I don't even remember that. It was a good film. And Malkovich made the movie. Yeah, the assassin made the movie. Clint Eastwood was good, as usual. But it was Malkovich who really had it together. Well, we all have sort of liked Johnny Cash over the years. In fact, I've sang a lot of his songs, but I do early on in California, because I went to a couple of his concerts, that June Carter, his wife, had totally screwed him around and got him into this Christian Zionism. I know I went to one of his concerts, and she took over, and most of the show was singing Christian songs. Well, it says here, Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash were deeply religious people whose personal and professional lives were imbued with a sense of spiritual struggle and religious engagement. See, that's the way it goes. People who have problems with drugs, alcohol, and so forth, they'll flip over and then they'll get drunk and absorbed in religion because they're weak. The 2005 biopic Walk the Line was very good at depicting the sex, drugs, and rock and roll aspect of Cash's life and art. But like almost all Hollywood movies, it steers clear of religion in general and of evangelical Protestant religion in particular. Also left out of the film was the story of Johnny and June Cash, Carter Cash's passionate engagement with Israel, an engagement that grew out of their religious beliefs. That probably is why he was able to get a nationally syndicated show on TV back in the 70s. John's interest in Israel started with a wish to visit the Christian holy sites and walk where Jesus walked. Well, if you can find a place where Jesus walked, you're a better man than I am, because if he didn't exist, he couldn't walk. Cash's initial visit to Israel in 66 was followed by a trip with June in 1968 and developed into a lifelong project to service advocates for the state of Israel, even when such advocacy was unfashionable among American performing artists. Brought up in the devout Baptist home, Johnny Cash was introduced to music through the local church choir in which his mother sang. She taught Johnny scores and hymns and songs, and it was at age 10, in order to accompany his mother, he learned to play the guitar. Many decades later, Cash told an interviewer that of the over 200 albums that he had recorded, his favorite was My Mother's Hymn Book, in which he plays songs that his mother sang in church. Whoopee. Many decades later, Cash told an interviewer that, among these moving songs, I'm Bound for the Promised Land, which opens with an evocation of the singer standing on Jordan's stormy banks. Promised Land and many other songs that refer to Canaan, Jordan, Gilead, and Zion would have all been understood in the 1930s and 40s as rich metaphors that evoke biblical places in the service of spiritual ideas, a tradition that has deep roots in both white and black churches. Those are brain-twisting places, the churches. And the Promised Land idea informed the thinking of early American colonists and the Founding Fathers, who spoke of an American experiment as providing a promised land for refugees from tyranny of the English Pharaoh, George III. But for generations of American, among them Cash, ancestors, Zion, the Promised Land, was much more than a metaphor. It was Jesus' land. In the period after the Civil War, many among the American Christian elites flocked there. Steamship travel was made possible to sail from New York, Boston, or Charleston and reach the port of Jaffa in 3 weeks. Among some American Christians, the zeal for Zionism ran so high that they attempted to create colonies in Palestine. In the second half of the 19th century, before the major era of Zionist settlement, at least 4 such colonies were founded. Most of them failed, but the American colony of Jerusalem, co-founded by Swedish Christians, left its mark on Jerusalem. Of course, a lot of these Swedish Christians now go down to Africa and risk catching Ebola to take care of the darkies. Many writers on the subject of Christians and Zionism tend to emphasize the end-time theology of supporters of Israel. But the long view of American religious and social history reveals that American Christianity, in its many persuasions and denominations, has a very long history of engagement with the idea and reality of Zion. 11 years after their deaths, Johnny and June Carter Cash stand as exemplars of the complexity and depth of the American connection to both the idea and the reality of the Promised Land. Well, this article goes on and on and on. Typical Jewish propaganda. But actually, it's the Christian non-Jews that push it the most. You can see that article in the Tablet, a Jewish magazine. It's on the internet. What they don't tell these people is what the Christians say in the Bible, that if the Jews don't turn over and follow Jesus at the end, they're all going to be slaughtered by the Christians. How come very few people talk about that? Very few people. Well, boys, you better not go to Greece. They got a new law that bans Holocaust denial in Greece. In other words, if you disagree with the numbers of alleged Jews that died, hate speech legislation, a response to the rise of the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party. So there you go. If you go to Greece, don't say there was one killed. You got to say there were 6 million killed or you're going to jail. Well, I thought I'd be cute and revive my old, one of my old Macs. But I see that the audio is screwed up in the first 23, 24 minutes of the show. So you'll have to forgive me about that, and we'll try to do better next time. I got an interesting note back from, let's see, who was it? Michael Collins Piper. They were talking about a guy by the name of Bullock on the West Coast back in the day. Roy Bullock, who was an informant for the ADL and a homosexual. And I exposed him way back in the 80s, and evidently so did Michael Collins here. Michael Collins Piper. I keep mixing that up. Anyhow, they said he was exposed by a San Francisco newspaper. Well, that had to do with the lawsuit by several people against the ADL for smearing them and lying about them. One couple was leading the case. I tried to get into the case too, but the principals didn't want me into it. So, but at that time is when that came out. It was this lawsuit in San Francisco against the Anti-Defamation League, and the Anti-Defamation League lost the case. But Bullock was running around L.A. for a long time, snowing all these right-wingers. Well, anyhow, this is what Michael Collins Piper said. Yes, I wrote about Bullock back in 1986 in the Spotlight, though Mark Weber put up a great fuss at the time, insisting there was no proof. I guess the San Francisco papers writing about Bullock for the first time in December 1992 were enough proof for that eminent historian. Put on a pinstripe suit, a yellow tie, speak with a pseudo-British accent, and flash a Yale degree, and you can take over the right wing, especially if you have Jewish money out of New York City behind you. Just ask Jared Taylor. I'm not quite sure what he's referring to there. Put on a top hat and say you love the Confederate flag a whole bunch and act as a half-assed attorney while pimping informants for the feds, and you can infiltrate the right wing. Just ask Kirk Lyons. Well, I knew Kirk Lyons for years. I haven't talked to him for a long time, but he knows about the infiltrators and all that kind of stuff. But it's so easy to infiltrate the right wing. It's so easy. You don't have to be smart. You don't even have to be very smart at all. It's very easy. I reminded them also of a man by the name of, he went by the name of John Hart. His real name was Stanley Witek, who was leading a small splinter group of the American Nazis in L.A. And we knew he was an informant. We followed him to the Parker Center, police center in Los Angeles, and watched him flash a card and go right on up to the gang unit in Parker Center. We also followed him to an apartment that was full of wetbacks. He was making trips back and forth to Tijuana and obviously dealing with wetbacks. And on the time when, on the day where some of us were found guilty up there in court on the horrible charge of firing up refuse material without a permit. That was the Klan rally. I wasn't even involved in the Klan, in the rally part of it. Anyhow, he needed to get some money in case they put him right away in jail, because he was one of the people charged. So he calls his girlfriend. She comes up there. She's a swarthy wetback that didn't even speak English. But the guy continued to go to right-wing meetings long after I bowed out of that kind of stuff. So I'm telling you, if you go to these right-wing meetings, there is absolutely no security whatsoever. Well, the Untermenschen are on the running around again with their machetes. This is out of Chicago, I believe yesterday or day before. There were three or four Mexicans and one black.
Platform, two seemingly innocent riders surrounded by a group of teens and 20-somethings. One of the victims cut in the head with a machete, of all things. Police say it was because the victim refused to throw gang signs, claiming they weren't in a gang at all. We want to warn you, the video shows a violent attack that may be difficult to watch. This nearby surveillance camera, just feet from the ground line near Kedzie, captured two guys sitting alone shortly after midnight Monday. It's what happens next that turns an innocent train ride into a major felony crime. Seven people approach, six men and one woman. Police say the group asked the two men, ages 17 and 26, who were waiting, to show some gang signs. They wouldn't. That's when police say Mario Elvira pulled out a machete and started swinging. He struck the 26-year-old, according to police, leaving deep cuts to his neck and head. We stopped the videotape because he kept violently swinging until the next train showed up on the platform and perhaps forced the group to run. Police later caught up with the four adults and three juveniles charged with the incident. 18-year-old Mario Elvira, 19-year-old Kevin Ramirez, 20-year-old Kavar Preston, and 23-year-old Jean Salvatierra, all charged with robbery, aggravated battery, and trespassing on the CTA. The three minors, two males and one female, also face charges. The gang scare with a deadly weapon of a different sort, leaving this neighborhood on edge tonight.
Gun violence, I feel like, is something we're so accustomed to, but a machete is something that you have to be in such close range, and you have to be carrying that around with such an intent to hurt someone. So that's definitely something that makes me feel very uncomfortable.
It's such a shock, and to be, like, living here close, it even scares me to ride.
Scares a lot of people tonight, those that we talked to anyway. The victim was rushed to Swedish Covenant Hospital, and at last check, he is alive and was listed in stable condition. Micah?
Well, since this is 9/11 day, 9/11, how about that? Let's hear some more conjecture about what the hell happened.
Well, the commission that investigated the 9/11 attacks told that lead hijacker Mohammed Atta had been identified and as al-Qaeda operative more than a year before terrorists struck.
Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer is a Bronze Star recipient who told congressional staff members from the 9/11 commission that a secret military unit working with the International Intelligence Apparatus and the Defense Intelligence Agency had identified two of the three cells involved in the 9/11 attacks, as well as alleged ringleader Mohammed Atta, over a year before the attacks.
Schaefer says the commission never got the whole story.
I'm told confidently by the person who did move the material over that the 9/11 commission received two briefcase-size containers of documents. I can tell you for a fact that would not be one-twentieth of the information that Able Danger consisted of during the time we spent.
The 9/11 Commission was told information on Able Danger, but for some reason, completely left it out of their report.
They never got the story on Able Danger. I can tell you right now emphatically, the 9/11 Commission doesn't have a clue. Now, they may say, well, we asked the Defense Department for this information. Well, that's just passing the buck.
So what did Able Danger do with the information?
Schaefer says his unit linked Atta to al-Qaeda leaders, but would not provide any specifics.
It was over a year before the attacks, and the top-level classified spy program made the decision to bring the FBI in to take out the cells they were monitoring.
As to what he did with the information he had,
we attempted to, first off, use it operationally. The lawyers said you can't do that. Therefore, at that point in time, we made a determination as a team that we should move this information to the FBI.
But he says beginning in September 2000, three meetings he set up with the FBI were each canceled by military lawyers.
Abel Danger was not monitoring random suspects, but specifically the cells involved in the future 9/11 attacks. Abel Danger specifically could have arrested and entirely prevented the attacks themselves.
And I'm quoting how I remember saying it. We found, as part of the data run, we found two of the three cells which conducted the 9/11 attacks, to include Atah.
When Abel Danger was called to the Senate investigations, the Pentagon attempted to prevent the sharing of the information and asked for secret closed-door hearings without the media present.
The Pentagon reportedly does not want the public to hear next week's Senate testimony about the former secret intelligence unit known as Abel Danger. Two congressional sources have told Fox News that the military's pressuring senators to move the hearings behind closed doors. But we're told the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Arlen Specter, wants to keep the hearings open. People who claim they used to work with the Abel Danger unit say that unit identified as threats four of the September 11 hijackers a full year before the attacks.
I was assigned the same core team of analysts that worked the JCAG project. And along with Dr. Arlene Pricer as the analytical lead, four of us conducted data mining analysis on the Al-Qaeda terrorist network coordinated with SOCOM and other organizations throughout that time. In the months that followed, we were able to collect an immense amount of data for analysis that allowed us to map Al-Qaeda as a worldwide threat with a surprisingly significant presence within the United States.
Weldon, a Republican congressman, was the individual who called for the investigation, which he believed was the most important story in our nation related to 9/11, which was the fact that this specific group tried to stop the attacks, but were not allowed to. This was potentially the biggest scandal in our nation's history since Iran-Contra, and very few news outlets seemed to cover this detail. Abel Danger collected over 2.5 terabytes of information on the Al-Qaeda operations, including the majority of the few cells operating inside the United States, participating in the planning of 9/11. So what happened to the information? It was deleted.
What knowledge, if any, do you have about the allegation of a destruction of documents?
The allegation of destruction of documents is correct. I'm the one who deleted all the documentation that we had gathered at the IDC.
And what, you deleted the data?
Yes, sir.
What kind of information was deleted?
Everything. Everything that we had.
What was the essential substance of that?
We had done internet polls related to a preliminary analysis of Abel Danger. And what I mean by that is we were trying to get a worldwide perspective of exactly where this organization functioned and operated just as they start. And that was in terms of Al-Qaeda.
The majority of the members involved in the military program were ordered to stay silent or face consequences.
For the life of me, I don't understand why... As I understand it, I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I understand the witnesses we assumed we were going to get to hear from the Defense Department have been pulled. They may be or may not be in the room, but have instructed that they cannot testify.
They were gagged. Only one member spoke at the Senate investigation. The charts and documents that they had in their unit were conveniently destroyed, and no one person would ever be allowed to verify their claims. And the individual who deleted the information was also asked if he, too, could verify that what he deleted confirmed that the unit had identified Muhammad Atta, specifically as a terrorist in the United States planning an attack for Al-Qaeda.
Are you in a position to evaluate the credibility of Captain Philpott, Colonel Schaefer, Mr. Westfall, Ms. Preisler, Mr. J.D. Smith, as to their... credibility when they say they saw Muhammad Atta on a chart?
Yes, sir. I believe them implicitly from the time that I worked with all of them, and everyone you had mentioned was part and I had contact with during this time.
So how were the members who went public dealt with by their superiors?
A Pennsylvania congressman says there's a smear campaign going on inside the Pentagon. He wants the defense chief to get to the bottom of it. Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon says Pentagon officials are trying to ruin one of their own who's gone public about a top-secret military intel unit. This is the unit called Able Danger that claims to have ID'd the top 9/11 hijacker a full year before the attack. Catherine Herridge in the Fox Report live from our Washington newsroom. Catherine.
Yeah, Rick, Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon is calling for a new probe into what he describes as a witch hunt by defense officials against a member of Able Danger, the secret military intelligence team that claims to have identified lead hijacker Mohammed Atta 1 year before the attack. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, who was the first member of Able Danger to go public, has now been told in writing by the Defense Intelligence Agency that he can't speak to members of Congress or their staff without prior approval. And now a security clearance, which allowed him to deal with classified information, has been pulled. The congressman says Schaefer has been gagged, punished, for speaking up.
It's obvious to me this is a clear attempt to silence this guy, but now even more than to silence him, to ruin him as a person and a military officer. I've talked to all the Able Danger players, and they all agree this is a witch hunt against Tony. It's wrong. It's un-American. It's unacceptable.
In a recent letter to Secretary Rumsfeld, the congressman writes, "You know as well as I that inside the Beltway, there is a time-honored tradition of smearing the accuser rather than answering the charge. That method is now apparently being employed in your department, and while it may be a familiar way of doing business in Washington, it is no less disappointing." The congressman wants the Defense Department's internal watchdog, the Inspector General, to investigate whether Schaefer has been targeted for speaking out, and Weldon says the head of the House Armed Services Committee is backing the request. According to several published reports, the Defense Intelligence Agency has had no comment on the congressman's allegation.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to offer my comments surrounding the use of the security clearance system as a method of intimidation and retaliation. And in my case, DI removal of my security clearance based on my protected disclosures of information to the 9/11 Commission and to Congress regarding Operation Able Danger. Many of us take seriously our oath of office to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We demonstrate our commitment by decades of service to this country, trying to conduct operations to ensure our citizens are protected. There are officers within the bureaucracy who abandon their oath of office and simply become focused on a strategy of self-preservation, with obstruction of accountability. A culture now exists in which leaders with this abhorrent set of values are in charge of large portions of the intelligence community.
The staffer on the 9/11 Commission for Jeannie Gorelick was Dieter Snell. Dieter Snell was the one who interviewed Scott Philpott in July of 04. It was Dieter Snell, an Annapolis graduate, and a man who will take over the command of one of our destroyers in January. His credibility has never been challenged by anyone in the Pentagon. It was Scott Philpott who was debriefed by Dieter Snell who buried the story and did not allow the 9/11 commissioners to receive the facts of Able Danger. In fact, in talking to Scott Philpott, he gave me a direct quote from Dieter Snell. Now remember, the Congress, in a bipartisan vote, established the commission to get the facts about 9/11. And the facts obviously involved Al-Qaeda and obviously involved Mohammed Atta. In September of July of 04, a Navy officer, Annapolis grad, voluntarily goes in to debrief the 9/11 commission staff, and he mentions that he will swear on his entire life career that he identified Mohammed Atta in January of 2000 and that his team had a chart with Mohammed Atta's name on it and face on it, but also that he saw that chart over and over again. It wasn't a one-time glance. And he also told Dieter Snell that they tried to transfer that information to the FBI. This was Dieter Snell's response. Quote, "What do you want us to do with this information? We go to print in 10 days. End quote.
So there you go, 9/11. They all knew about it. They all knew about it. Can you believe it? Yeah, I can believe it. That's how corrupt this country's become, probably because they didn't want to embarrass Saudi Arabia. Defend Saudi Arabia at all costs. or whoever else is involved in this mess. But it's going to be just like most of the other conspiracies. It won't be. No one will ever go to jail. No one will ever be tried. But you got plenty of time to send low-level drug people to prison, or somebody who steals a loaf of bread at the local liquor store. This Washington, D.C. has probably become the most corrupt institution in the history of the world. But I do believe as time goes on, there are going to be more and more of these people who are working for the federal government become so sick of the mess, they're going to change sides. And that's when things will start changing. Boy, talk about the pan calling the pot black. Israeli Jew authorities have employed the coercion policy to force almost 7,000 African asylum seekers back to leave Israel, putting them at risk of imprisonment, so-called, and torture upon returning to their home countries. Well, obviously, if Israel operated more correctly, I'd be more sympathetic, because obviously a country the size, less than the size of Rhode Island, I believe, you can't have thousands of niggers coming across your border. Same way we can't have millions of people coming across our border. But they're doing it. The report released on Tuesday found that 6,400 Sudanese asylum seekers and another 367 Eritreans left Israel for their home countries by the end of June, which is smart of Israel. Home to approximately 50,000 African asylum seekers, Israel recognized only two Eritreans and one Sudanese refugees at the same time. Well, let's bring over your top man in this area in immigration to the United States. Maybe he can handle the border better. It looks to me like he can. Quote, we've documented how some Sudanese are detained, interrogated, tortured, put in solitary confinement, and charged with treason for visiting Israel. Well, go home. Go home if you don't like it. While Eritreans face detention and torture by officials who consider evasion of indefinite national military service an act of treason, Gary Simpson, a senior refugee researcher, said. Well, they're getting a taste of their own medicine, you know. A large number of Jews over here, powerful Jews, are all for opening the borders. And here you go. We got big problems. They've got big problems right there in Israel. Yes, they do. And I hope it gets worse. I told you a few months ago they're building one of the largest prisons in the world in southern Israel to house these people and then get rid of them, which we should be doing. How about white beggars on the streets of South Africa? Linda Elfs, 58, spends 8 hours at a street corner in Hartbeespoort Dam, a small tourist town in the northwest province of South Africa, begging for money. White people. She is too young to get state pension and too old to be hired, she says. A former nurse and bartender, she joins the ranks of unemployed white South Africans 8 years ago, and her life has since become a struggle. On a good day, I make 400 rand, or $37.57, which is not enough to pay for rent or food, she says. Donovan Moolman, 46, has been begging on the streets of Johannesburg for 6.5 years. While the rich upper class and the bankers and so forth got out or have plenty of money in a protected house in a being circled with walls. With just a matric certificate, he struggled to find employment and began doing menial jobs like gardening and painting homes. Now he says those jobs are gone. Yeah. Once you find yourself in the streets, it's hard to break the cycle, Moolman told Al Jazeera. We are struggling to find out because we don't have homes. People won't give you a job without a residential address because they don't trust you. Poverty, still believed to be the preserve of black South Africans, now knows no color. It is finding its way to white communities, once associated only with wealth and privilege. Well, It's time to get the wealth and privilege back, or at least a living standard, and that's what it's going to take, the uprising of the working class, and quit listening to the ruling class. They're your enemies. And the working class, white working class, is going to have to strike out on their own, no matter where you're at in the world, and not be waiting around for handouts from the super rich. In fact, they should be hung. They still got plenty of slavery in Yemen, the country of Yemen. You hear Al Sharpton and these boys talking about that? What are they going to do about slavery that exists in Yemen? If you get a chance, ask those people. No, those assholes. Here's one other thing I can't understand in this Ukraine versus Russia deal, or these groups of pro-Russians inside Ukraine, by one of their leaders says, the historic mission of our nation in this critical moment is to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival. Well, I've got nothing wrong. I find nothing wrong with that. A crusade against the Semite-led Untermenschen, subhumans, he wrote in recent article cited in the newspaper. Well, then why are you shooting Ukrainians? Why are you blowing up Ukrainians' houses? Non-Jewish, Gentile, white Ukrainians, and back and forth. You can't say you're for a crusade for the white race when you turn right around and you're bombing and blowing up and machine gunning non-Jew white people. You sound like an idiot. You know, Mother Nature keeps trying to help the white race, and we keep fighting her. We keep fighting nature, just like Christianity fights nature. They reject nature and the natural order. Just like we're sending all these white doctors down there to Africa to save blacks. What are you saving them for? They're going to end up starving to death anyhow. Anyhow, here's a little clip of what's going on down there.
Outside the John F. Kennedy Hospital in Monrovia, Liberia. 20-year-old Ibaga Stiwo is sick.
Oh, no. Mother, why would you not?
His parents wait beside him. All signs point to the late stages of Ebola, the deadly virus that's killed more than 2,300 across West Africa.
He's just vomiting, he's vomiting, he's vomiting. You're going to get a paper back.
As sick as he is, he won't be allowed inside. The largest hospital in the nation, and many others just like it, are completely full.
But I want to tell you, any hospital now will go to the same one. They say we should wear the titles.
Al Sharpton, where are you when we need you, baby?
Betsy Solomon in Monrovia, Liberia. This city of 1.5 million is the first major metropolitan area to face an Ebola outbreak since the virus was discovered in 1976.
Jesse Jackson, when you going to give me some money?
And the World Health Organization expects thousands of new cases in the coming weeks. With a limited number of hospital beds and personnel to treat the sick, many of the infected are left to die at the hospital gates.
It's heartbreaking. There's nothing I can do about it because I have no space. I don't have the capacity.
Local and foreign-run treatment centers alike are unable to cope with the surge. Here are the Doctors Without Borders Treatment Center. They too are at capacity.
What we're looking at here is about a 350-bed hospital. No one has done this before. To turn people away at the door that are sick, that is a new experience and a difficult one to handle because we are full every
He's
day.
An Aryan Nordic.
We are not capable of building fast enough.
10 to 15 die each day here, but their beds quickly filled. The virus is spreading fast among families in Monrovia slums, and with an incubation period over several weeks, no one knows exactly how many more patients will arrive in the months ahead.
If you look back in time, MSF have been able to cope with outbreaks that have been going on from year to year because they have been small, but at the moment we are down on our knees. So who else is there?
After a few hours outside, a crowd formed around Ibaga and his family. Many were angry, urging them to go home.
They say because the violence, the people will not look at us, so we should tell them back to the hospital.
The hospital worker finally came out to calm the crowd.
The war is for most important questions. You understand?
So I did not elaborate.
But for the objective
therapy. Later in the afternoon, Bago was finally admitted. For his family, what comes next remains a mystery.
Every day they're making announcements. When you get a sick patient, report a sick patient. Same with truth. Nothing they are doing. Just saying, oh, wait. We're waiting. We don't know what to do.
African blacks have been waiting for a million years. Nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is when the white man comes in, bring cars in, brings TVs in, comes in to take the goodies in the ground, the oil and so forth. But they don't change. They're not going to change. You can't save them. You cannot save them. All these progressives and these religious nuts, you got to let Mother Nature take its course. Nature will take its course, but if we don't watch out, the course is going to be, she say, well, if you don't take care of the, if you don't walk away from this, I'm going to turn it on you. Massive Ebola dying in the United States and Europe, because Mother Nature gets angry, and it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. Well, a congressman down there in Missouri's office was firebombed. I wonder, oh, that's Emmanuel Cleaver. I bumped heads with Emmanuel Cleaver way back when he was working as a mayor of, what was he, mayor of Oklahoma City or one of those cities out there, when he tried to get our Race and Reason TV show shut down. And the way it ended up, they shut the whole public access system down just to get rid of our show. Emmanuel Cleaver, somebody bombed his office. Oh, and the FBI is looking into it. Well, I hope they don't look into it too hard.
Investigation taking place into what happened at a Missouri congressman's office this morning. Kansas City's Martin Augustine outside Representative Emmanuel Cleaver's Kansas City office on 31st Street. Martin?
Good morning, Matt. Anytime there's vandalism at an elected official's office or home or something like that, it's of concern, especially so when the police bomb and arson squad is called. This is the congressman's office back here, and the window you see on the side patched up by that board, that was broken out this morning, an alarm going off shortly before 3. Police were sent to check out that alarm, and what they saw after looking over that damage worried them enough that they called out investigators from their own bomb and arson squad. Now, what the bomb and arson squad found, we don't know yet, not specifically anyway. They came out, conducted an investigation, wrapped it up in fairly short order before leaving the congressman's office here. So we don't know precisely what they found, but again, it was enough to bring bomb and arson out here. We've been sending messages to the congressman's press staff to try and see if they can square away anything with us to provide more detail other than the fact that there was vandalism that brought bomb and arson out. But that's kind of where we stand at this point. Fortunately, it seems though nobody was injured as a result of this, and there doesn't seem to be any serious damage besides the broken window. Reporting live, Martin Augustine, KBC 9 News.
What they're talking about is about a 10-inch diameter hole in a window. And I think there's a broken glass up in the ceiling, just a small broken glass. So we got to pull all stops for Emmanuel Cleaver, that bastard. I debated him a couple of times. He reminded me of one of the comedians, Eddie Murphy, I think it was. But that's how vindictive he was. He closed down the whole system. Public television out there, just to get our show off. And that was one that Dennis Mahan was working with, too. Anyhow, that's showbiz. FBI comes running. If you had a little hole in your window and a little hole in your ceiling glass, you think the FBI would come on out? Why, they'd laugh their ass off. Don't call me back until Emmanuel Cleaver has real problems. However, a congressman anymore means nothing. They're all just on a take. That's it. So why get excited about it? He's just no better, no worse than any of the other niggers and the white niggers, too. Well, here we go again. Boehner, Boehner, Booner, or whatever you want to call him up there in the Congress, once reluctant to take a stand on fighting Islamic militants overseas, now appears eager to do so and willing to spend more and more and more money and get more and more and more white troops killed. As Republicans in the House largely backed President Obama's proposal to arm Syrian rebels. Now, when any time the Democrats come up with any kind of a plan to help the common people in the working class, forget it. But boy, whenever there's a war, the Republicans are there Johnny on the spot. Johnny on the spot. They've never seen a war they didn't love, you know. They used to accuse the Democrats of that with FDR and Wilson, but the Democrats sort of got out of it except for like Johnson and people like that, but it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. They got to borrow the money from China to fight another war. Well, here's an interesting news article. Call it The Laptop from Hell, a terrifying trove of documents discovered on a laptop computer apparently recently seized from an ISIS fighter in Syria, show how to commit mass biological warfare attacks against non-Muslims, revel in Nazi ideology, and offers a banana mouse mousse recipe too. Well, between 2009 and 2013, the device's owner, reputedly a 24-year-old Tunisian national named Mohamed S., studied chemistry and physics and stuffed the computer with a whopping 146 gigabytes of material containing a total of 33,347 files in 2,367 folders. Wow, man. Wow. The advantage of biological weapons is that they do not cost a lot of money. That's right. You can brew them up in your bathtub. While the human casualties can be huge. Look at Ebola. A cheap 19-page instructional document apparently has sort of frequently asked questions on how to murder millions was among the material found on the device, which was reportedly confiscated in January. Use small grenades with the virus and throw them in closed areas like metros, soccer stadiums, or entertainment centers. The document reads, best to do it next to the air conditioning. It also can be used during suicide operations. Instructions were also provided on how to prepare the incredibly toxic poison, ricin, made from a particular strain of castor beans. In a 26-page long Islamic ruling, also hidden in a laptop, allows believers to use weapons of mass destruction to reach their goals. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Isn't that what our government does? What do you call ICBMs and atomic bombs and nuclear and biological warehouses all over the United States? That's just, oh, man. Even if it kills all of them and wipes them and their descendants off the face of the earth, he wrote, at least 2,400 Tunisians were fighting in Syria as Islamic State terrorists, Tunisia's Interior Ministry said in June, according to the Lebanon Daily Star, which you can't believe a goddamn word they're saying. I don't believe any press. I read about it, but I don't necessarily believe it. That's right. Wait a minute here. Let me get this stopped. Here's a comment to the last article For God's sake, do not let the White House get access to that laptop. They would probably start handing out laptops at the border, since Obama wants to whittle America down to the size. This information would be very useful for those terrorists to comply with his dictates. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow, Freya's Day, Friday, and I'll see if I can piece these two parts of this show together and make it make sense. So, sorry about that. 14-5 and shut up.
No one questions things. You remember Barbara Bush? I call her the silver douchebag. You remember her? Barbara Bush. She is the mother of Governor George Bush. I call him Governor Bush because that's the only elected office he ever held legally in our country. Okay? George Bush, Governor Bush. I don't care where they hang his portrait. I don't care how big his library is. He'll always be Governor Bush. I don't even capitalize his name when I type it anymore. So she's the mother of Governor George Bush. She's also the wife of his father, George H.W. Bush, who did become president in a normal, legal, traditional manner. And when he did, she came along for the ride as first lady. And that's been the tradition up till now. A man has been elected and the woman has come along for the ride as the first lady. And usually, as in American life in general, the woman is condescended to, patronized, given something to do to keep her busy. A lot of times they give her a charity or a cause, something she can champion. Betty Ford was told to drink. Remember that? That's right. Betty Ford was told, you drink, Betty. Betty, you drink and get really fucked up, okay? Just get totally fallen down, fucked up, drunk, shit-faced, and blow your liver out. Blow your fucking liver out, honey. Then we'll hose you down and we'll put you in a place and get you well there and put your name on the place and Liza Minnelli can get well and everything's going to be okay. So, that was her assignment. That was her assignment. Barbara Bush's assignment was getting children to read. Remember that? Getting children to read. They figured she had had so much success with George. That she would be a natural to get children to read, which misses the point completely. Not important to get children to read. Children who want to read are going to read. Kids who want to learn to read are going to learn to read. Much more important to teach children to question what they read. Children should be taught to question everything. To question everything they read, everything they hear. Children should be taught to question authority. Parents never teach their children to question authority because parents are authority figures themselves and they don't want to undermine their own bullshit inside the household. So they stroke the kid and the kid strokes them and they all stroke each other and they all grow up all fucked up and they come to shows like this.